All right. Before I switch gears, other questions about asbestos?
Well, for that matter, anything else we've covered?
I realized this morning I had assumed that I had put the networking stack paper on this a little bit long ago at the time that I put on the windowing system paper. I discovered it this morning that I had not. It's now on the syllabus. I shoved it in for this week. Obviously, you're not going to read it by yesterday. In fact, probably at this point you won't bother because all students optimize for least work. It's actually, I think, you know, it's an interesting paper. Okay, not because it's a tour de force of networking, but because it's another one of these papers that explores how a bunch of networking problems come together. And some of those problems are security problems, but actually the big problem is a problem that's more or less intrinsic to synchronous communication systems. So it actually runs into some issues that are going to be generic to all robust microkernels. Okay. So let me try to sketch what the problem is. If you think about the system architecture that is in this picture, at the bottom you have an Ethernet card. Okay. And the basic mechanism of interaction between the Ethernet card and the rest of the system has two parts. Right? One is that there's a mechanism for data transfer, depending on the card, that can be programmed I/O, or it could be DMA, it could even be busmaster and DMA, it doesn't really matter. Because that's actually not the part that's tricky. Well, let me be careful. On the incoming side, that part's tricky. The reason it's tricky is you want to make sure that the packet ends up in the right place, and that's where we get into the packet filtering stuff we talked about several class days ago. But data motion is basically data motion. You've got to worry about storage allocation, where's the data going. But the interesting part of the interface for purposes of the networking paper, the most interesting part, is how the card and the OS synchronize with each other. Okay. So let me sort of draw a little picture about what's happening conceptually on these cards. And there are more sophisticated, in fact, now almost all the cards and chipsets are more sophisticated than the story I'm about to tell you, but the story, you know, in suitably embellished form is still roughly accurate. On an Ethernet chip, okay, there are two FIFOs. And what happens on the input side is that, you know, the incoming data comes in until it hits some sort of high watermark. Okay, and actually on modern cards there's often a low watermark as well. The high watermark is about, I'm running out of FIFO and I'm going to have to start dropping packets. So that's sort of your last chance to go get the data before things start to get corrupted. And generally speaking, on the early chips, this FIFO may or may not be big enough to hold a full packet. On most of the chips, by the time you hit the later 10 megabit chips and all of the 100 megabit chips, you got several packets, even larger packets. The low watermark is a way to deal with interrupt latency. Okay, so here's the idea. The chip, very early in the incoming packet, one of the things that's in the front of the header in the Ethernet frame, assuming we're talking about Ethernet, is a length field. Okay, so at this point, the chip knows how many words are coming, and ignoring the possibility of collision, right? It knows what the bit rate is of the wire, and so it knows when that packet's going to be fully present. The OS, and so we have both a size knowledge and a latency knowledge. The OS, for its part, knows how bad the interrupt handling mechanism is in software, and also hardware. You get no help from those great people at Intel here because they really want interrupts to be as slow as possible.
A brief diversion. So for a variety of reasons, I found myself looking at the specifications for the CPU ID instruction. For Intel processors alone, it's a 74-page procedure to determine which processor version you're on. There's something wrong with this picture.
So the idea with the low watermark is I would actually like to issue the interrupt to myself before the packet is fully there. Because it's going to take a while for the software to actually do the interrupt and get back to the hardware. And during that latency, the packet's still coming in, but by the time I get there, the packet will be fully present. So the really aggressive operating systems actually tend to push the watermark down to mask that latency. And you're fighting two different issues here. Why do I want a low watermark? Well, hey, I want to get the packet into processing as fast as possible. Why do I want a high watermark? Well, if I get a lot of packets coming, I don't want to take an interrupt for every packet. I kind of want to batch them together. Okay, and this is now, so there's actually a range of options that are between polling, schedule polling, and pure interrupts. You can also do interrupts with some latency control. So on the input side, in practice, you only use one watermark, and that's determined by what strategy you're doing. And when the watermark is hit on the way in, the chip generates an interrupt saying, hey, I've got an incoming packet, you better get around to doing something about it. More precisely, I have some number of incoming packets according to how you set the watermark. You don't even know exactly what the number is, because they could be a lot of small packets or a bunch of big packets. There's a second possible reason that you can interrupt, okay, which is that generally you have two settings. You have a watermark and a timeout. Okay, so the watermark deals with the case where you've got a flood of packets coming in and you're going to run out of storage. And the timeout deals with the case where one packet came in, right, and that packet is the only thing you've got. And it's sitting down here at the bottom of the FIFO and we're nowhere near the watermark and we're in no danger of hitting it. Well, you don't want that packet to sit there forever, right? So you set up a watchdog timer that only triggers if there's something to do. On the outbound side, you actually really do have you have a different watermark, okay? You have a low watermark. The idea on the outbound side is I'm stuffing a packet into the chip for transmission. Now the chip is basically going to do a bit copy of this packet. The only field of the packet that's actually modified by most Ethernet controllers is that most controllers will insert the MAC address, the Ethernet layer MAC address, in the appropriate location as that word is going by. Okay? Some of them will automatically do length. But most of them don't do anything more than that. Now, so the story here is, I want to shove packets into this thing as hard as I can go, but at some point the chip's only got so much memory. Okay. So what happens is I fill up this FIFO, and I then have to wait for the FIFO to drain before I can shove more data in, and I'm going to interrupt there. The interrupt in the low watermark is, so in principle I'd like to interrupt when the FIFO is zero, assuming my interrupt had no latency. Right? What I want to know is, there's lots more room, go to town. Okay. Here again, you adjust the watermark to allow for the fact that you know what your outbound data rate is, you know how fast the FIFO is draining, you know that the processor's going to take some time to respond to the interrupt, right? So you actually issue a little ahead of being empty in anticipation of the interrupt delay. All of this is about lowering the net delay. So, what's happening here is that there are interrupts going from the hardware into the operating system. And those interrupts get fielded by the microkernel.
Okay.
And in effect, what happens is they cause some queue to get woken up.
Who's waiting on the queue? By the way, this is the queue bitmap pair, because there's now a race between the driver is waiting for the next interrupt, but it might not have gotten here. So if it's waiting, we're just going to wake it up and we're good. If nobody's waiting, we're going to set a bit, and then the next time it comes into wait, we'll say, no, 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 there's already an interrupt for you. Okay, so it's an interlock kind of a pattern.
Okay, and up here we have the Ethernet, okay, which we hope, and most of the time it will be, is sitting in a call, and this call is basically, it's a wait for interrupt call. Interrupt. On the Ethernet queue. Now, synchronous IPC. Synchronous IPC means if I send a message to you, a message only goes through if you're in the receiving state. The Ethernet in this situation is not in a receiving state. It's not in an open wait, which is the one where you're ready for another request. It's in a closed wait. In fact, the kernel's cheating. It's not in a wait at all. It's just on a queue. It's blocked. This means that above this Ethernet, there's a TCP/IP stack, okay? And that TCP/IP stack is trying to do a send, and it can't make any progress because the Ethernet isn't in an open wait. So what we have here is a situation where there's a component that in some sense wants to be called from two sides. Right? It wants, in the downward direction, wants to be called from the TCP/IP side to say to the Ethernet, here's more data. And from the bottom, it wants to be called by the kernel to say there's an interrupt ready for you. There's a problem with this. The kernel does not initiate calls. Okay? Can't. And that's a big mess. This problem manifests again at the next level up. Okay? Because look at what happens when the Ethernet has a packet and it's picked out a TCP/IP stack and it's trying to deliver the packet upwards. Okay. Whatever the mechanism, could be a shared memory mechanism, we could do a ring buffer, cool. But we still need exactly the logical mechanism that we had at the hardware level, something to tell us that there's something in the damned ring buffer. Okay, and that requires a communication. So what's going to happen now is the Ethernet is going to try to ascend upwards. And at this point, I apologize that I didn't draw the picture a little lower down because now I need to sort of turn right. But imagine I'm drawing up here on the cinder block. That would be sort of amusing, but with white chalk, I don't think it would get us very far. And the app is in exactly the same situation, right? That it's waiting for data or it's trying to send data to the TCP/IP stack. Now, generally, the application's only doing one of these. But still, TCP/IP stack is in a situation where it's being called from above and called from below, and that's actually not so bad, except it's implementing a full duplex channel, just like the Ethernet is, so it can actually be getting called from both directions at once. And here, for real fun, not at the Ethernet level, but at the TCP/IP level, you have flow control mechanisms, just like you do in a terminal, which means that something proceeding up the stack can cause a change of state in the downward processing chain that basically says, back the hell off, there's no more room for packets on the wire. These channels are not independent. Flow control creates crosstalk between the channels. Now you can do this, you can do all of this, by having two threads in each agent.
It doesn't help.
Because if you switch to two threads, what you're going to discover is that now you've got to do exactly the same kind of coordination, except now you're going to do it at the point where the flow control happens. There's no way to get out of this without crosstalk between the channels.
Aha. But it gets better. This is not a relationship of symmetric trust.
We do not assume that the TCP/IP stack is trustworthy from the perspective of the Ethernet. In fact, we can't assume the user's even running the TCP/IP stack. The Ethernet going upwards is doing packet forwarding. So it has an independently established criteria for whether the Ethernet packet will go to this processing stack, which might or might not be TCP/IP. But you might want to implement a user-defined protocol here. You're going to use the packet filter to avoid certain kinds of security hazards. But you might want to experiment with a new protocol. Even if you don't, TCP/IP is a complicated protocol. There's a lot of code in there, and it really is possible that the TCP/IP stack will just fail. Right? It'll take an exception. It'll die. What happens if it dies is that when the Ethernet attempts to send a message to it, guess what's going to happen? The TCP/IP stack, having ceased to execute instructions, is almost certainly not in an open wait state. The Ethernet stack, if it were to attempt to upcall the TCP/IP stack, would block. We're done doing networking. Now, I have to say, having watched some of our travels across the Hopkins network, the idea that we would be done doing networking is not all bad, okay? But it's not the outcome we're after, okay? So we're in this very curious race in two directions, and for the same reason, the application would prefer not to trust the TCP stack. It could fail, it could be compromised. And the good news here is that this so in the Aeros networking stack, TCP/IP is multiply instantiated. So we do get to assume that this TCP/IP stack is working exclusively on behalf of this particular application. If two applications have independent TCP/IP connections in this system, they have independent copies of TCP/IP. They're sharing code, but separate data. I'm not sure how well that scales, and at some point we may have to look at that. But given that on a typical machine, a given server may have gobs of connections, but there's a limited number of servers, this gives us some isolation of failure. So what's happening here is that the synchronicity is screwing up the communication flow. And synchronous communication patterns seem to be very bad at handling bidirectional flows, full duplex flows. In L4, the solution to this would be a timeout. Okay. So what would happen in L4 is you design a protocol where you had some notification bit somewhere in shared memory, and the Ethernet would attempt to upcall TCP/IP, but it would do so with a zero timeout. And so if TCP/IP wasn't ready, that would be okay. And then we would design the higher level protocol, right, so that there would be some check that before TCP/IP went into the receive state, it would test this bit. Unfortunately, that protocol has an intrinsic race condition. Here's the race. There's a window of time where the network stack says, okay, I'm about to get ready to receive. So the first thing I gotta do, I gotta check if there's already something to do. Protocol is if there's nothing to do, now I'm gonna go into the receive state. If there is a mutually trusting relationship between the Ethernet and the TCP/IP stack, you can solve this problem with a second bit. The first bit says, I am about to receive. The second bit says there's already something to do. Now, here's what you do on the Ethernet side. If the TCP/IP stack has said, I am about to receive, you do a blocking set. Okay. Two things will happen. Either it's already receiving, the blocking send will go through quickly, you're good, or maybe it got preempted in like that three instruction window between these two things, but the minute it gets to run again, it's going to go into the receive state, you'll be good. If you trust the TCP/IP stack. And that race where you get hit in that window, it didn't really happen very often. Right? It's a latency issue, doesn't happen often enough to worry about. What about if you don't trust the damn TCP/IP stack? Now what? That design doesn't work now. There's no way to coordinate this with all the flow of control. So the situation is the flow of control, any blocking flow of control, always has to proceed from the lower trust party to the higher trust party. The higher trust party can never block for the lower trust party. Right? What we're concerned here is a control flow denial of service problem, either by virtue of threat or attack or simply by virtue of failure. And the failure one is actually the one to pay attention to, because what it says is you don't need to be trying to design a very secure system for this to be an issue. Yeah.
What was it again? The flow of trust has to go from the lower trust to the higher trust?
Yeah. Here's the rule. If I'm going to call you, I am relying on you to return. Right. If I don't rely on you, right. I better not rely on you to return. It's that simple. The flip side of that is, if I call you and I rely on you to return, right, it's silly to talk about my somehow not being exposed to your failures. I have a functional dependency on your correct behavior. And there are designs we can do where maybe we'll ship a request off to several different implementations, and one of them fails, that's okay. But there is still a reliance, and we either have to design a way to evade failure, or we got to deal with failure. And in the general case, evading hostility is actually quite hard. What we did in the Ethernet stack, we said, okay, what we got to do is invert some of these relationships to get the control flow going the right way. So the first problem is this Ethernet, that it can't be listening in two directions at once. So what we need to do is arrange that it doesn't have to. And what we did was change the architecture so that the Ethernet does not directly wait on this queue. What happens instead is that there is an IRQ helper. It waits on the queue, returns from the wait, and then calls the Ethernet to say, by the way, you got an interrupt. This little process, its only purpose is to solve the problem that the kernel can't initiate the call. And I'm going to come back to that issue. We did the same thing up here. Okay, so the problem here is the Ethernet can't upcall to a less trusted party. So what we did is we set things up again so that there is, I don't remember what it was called, an upcall helper. Okay, and the protocol with the upcall helper is that the upcall helper calls the Ethernet and is normally blocked. Okay. And the protocol here is, when there is something to tell the next guy up about, the Ethernet unblocks this party, allows the call to proceed, and returns the answer yes. And when that helper gets the answer yes, it goes and turns around and calls into the TCP/IP stack. Now, if I'm a TCP/IP stack and my helper gets blocked because I screwed up, that's on me. Okay, so you basically, by injecting the helper, you turn the protocol around. And instead of upcalling, you downcalling. And that's a generally viable design pattern. But
And this one is mitigated. Okay, it's mitigated because, in fact, the design uses a ring buffer, and so it's actually quite careful to try to get multiple packets into the ring buffer before it triggers this guy. The cost in this story is we're context switching out the wazoo. Right? We've now got two more address spaces in the picture. And that's a measurable cost. At a gigabit, that costs you about 10% relative to Linux. And it's all in the context switching. And the fix is in two places. So the first is my statement that the kernel can't upcall. That's not strictly right. Why can't the kernel upcall? It's not that I can't store a capability in the kernel for these dedicated data structures. It would be a very funny case. It's a special case. But the kernel can do this. There's nothing conceptually different between this and upcalling a fault handler. The difference is, in the fault handler case, if the fault handler is not available, what I do is I take the faulted process and stick it back on the run queue, on the ready queue. Okay? And then when it comes up to run, I notice, oh, this guy can't run, it's faulted. So instead of running, what it should do instead, it should cause me to re-attempt the upcall to the keeper. Eventually, that'll get the message through to the keeper. Okay? So the issue here is the kernel has a mechanism to make sure that if that upcall gets blocked, it gets retried. In this situation, if nobody's waiting, it's really hard for the kernel to know when to retry. So what we need here to do the upcall is a non-blocking notification mechanism. This is why non-blocking notification went into Coyotes. I'm going to go through this in more detail on Monday.
Or at least I'm going to go through it again.
If you have a non-blocking communication model, you can also get rid of the upcall helper. The issue here is not that the ENET could not call TCP/IP. The issue is that the ENET could not be blocked by TCP/IP's failure. Okay? So, the thing to pull away from this, and Monday I'll hit this again and I'll look at some of the buffering stuff because there is an interesting shared buffering problem that's worth looking at. But the thing to pull away from this is that a purely synchronous IPC model has some places, and they're not places you hit very often, but it has some places where, boy, it doesn't seem to be terribly convenient. It has a cost. There is a straightforward fix. That's to have some kind of a non-blocking mechanism. Right? It doesn't have to be like signals, which are badly busted. And it doesn't have to violate dynamic storage restrictions. Well, I think have I explained why it doesn't? Yeah, I think I did. Not all the way again. So you can manage this kinds of issue. And it turns out that if we take out these extra threads, then our belief is that the performance of this network stack is then, once again, competitive with monolithic kernels. Now, that's actually quite an amazing statement. Okay, because in a monolithic kernel, you have no context switch boundaries at all in the network stack. Right? There's one. It's between the app and TCP/IP. And TCP/IP and the Ethernet and the microkernel, they're all in the same address space. They're all running at a privilege level. There's no cost to get from one to the other. So it's really, frankly, pretty astounding that we got as close to monolithic performance at a gigabit as we did, because at a gigabit, you are pushing the processor pretty much as hard as it will go on that generation of machine. And so the great question to ask here is, how do we amortize these context switch costs out? And the answer is a shared memory ring buffer, which is, after all, how the processor amortizes those costs out between the processor and the card. Okay, and the second interesting part of this paper is how to build that shared memory ring buffer safely, and the pattern is very similar to the one in the Windows system with one additional complication, which is the need for inbound filtering, which I will go through on Monday because we've run out of time. Okay, but when people say synchronous IPC is the way to go, and when you design for 98% of the cases, you're done, the answer is, not if the 2% of the cases really matter. You may only do this 2% of the time, but if your machine doesn't talk to the outside world, there's a limit on its utility. And if the movie stutters, the customer will complain. All right.